Exactly.
But it goes on. So regardless of what these people are saying, you have to look at the results.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you find the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the words of politicians or commenters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of the results of what's happening. And the results are the extermination of the people. I just found out recently that they destroyed the third oldest church
exactly.
in the world.
Yeah.
So where are these Christian organizations and leaders of so-called Christianity from the Pope onwards? What are they doing about all this? They're certainly not being Christian.
Mm. Let me bring Mick in. You are actually experiencing firsthand the draconian measures that are being taken against people who speak out in support of Palestinian self-determination. Explain the charges that have been brought against you in Scotland for speaking up for Palestinian liberation.
Well, I mean, I would rather not talk about myself, but there's an opportunity here to show some aspect of the picture. If they're dropping bombs, if they're supporting genocide abroad, or if they're invading Iraq or some other country abroad and devastating that country, it has to be accompanied by repression at home, because popular opinion here is by no means behind the government policy. I mean, I've been charged, arrested and charged with offences under the Terrorism Act. Tony Greenstein, another prominent activist, has been arrested and also charged under terrorism. The ex-British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, was stopped at Glasgow Airport and told that he is under investigation for terrorism offences.
Wow.
So it's a thing. It's not just an individual here. They're trying to repress certain elements in the solidarity movement. My crime was to point out in a large public demonstration in Glasgow, thousands of people, that the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, had won the election in Palestine by a landslide the last time elections were held. And that therefore, because the Palestinian people later were punished for this election result, it really showed, if it needed to be showed, but it showed yet again that Britain's commitment to democracy is a complete sham. That was one half of my crime, and I'll be very happy to defend that on any forum, not just in court, but in the court of public opinion, with confidence that I'll win.
And Mick,
but the other crime, the other aspect of the charge is I said that I thanked Hamas and the Palestinian resistance for breaking out of the Gaza concentration camp on the 7th of October, because any other people in the same situation would have tried to do the same. And that although I am not personally a supporter of Hamas, I'm politically inclined to the left. Nonetheless, from Britain, while Britain is sending sniper rifle parts to the Israeli army, I support, and the demonstration supports unreservedly, the Palestinian right to resist what Israel is doing. That's the summary of my crimes, and we'll have to see what happens going forward.
And the fact that Britain has not revoked any licenses to sell weapons to the Israelis, despite the fact that under the premiership of David Cameron, who is now Foreign Secretary, that did happen in 2014, not this time around. But this weaponization of the courts to repress pro-Palestine solidarity, as you said earlier, when you look at the number of people who came out onto the streets in the past few months to support the Palestinian struggle, is that attempt by the UK government having any impact?
I don't think so. I think that they are afraid that the movement, I mean, a million people marching through London, in this country, that's unprecedented on the issue of Palestine. Mm. And we see people up and down the country invading arms factories and trying to interdict the supply chain. We see people invading railway stations and so on. The government's afraid that this could grow and become a serious threat, and that's why they're trying to use the law. But, you know, they don't have a great track record of success. Because popular opinion can see what Israel is doing and can see the crime and the genocide, although the political class is afraid to call it genocide, because of that, whenever we go to court, whenever people interrupt the production of arms companies and then go and then take their case to court, juries tend to acquit them, overwhelmingly acquit them. Mm. And their argument's very simple. If you're passing by a door behind which somebody is being abused, a child, for example, you're entitled in British law, case law, to smash down the door and rescue the child. Side, if I go to your house tomorrow and smash down your door, I should go to prison. It's a crime. But if I break down a door or invade an arms company in order to prevent Israel's huge crimes in Lebanon or in Palestine, juries will acquit the people who make that argument time after time after time. Mm-hmm. So they try to use the law, but it's not so simple. I mean, even when...
Sorry to interrupt you, Mick. It definitely is not simple, but since we're going to cover a lot of ground here, let's just move on, if that's okay. We talked about briefly the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. He, well, has called on Israel to take greater steps to protect civilians, allow more aid into the Gaza Strip, and work with handpicked Palestinian leaders, saying regional countries would only invest in the reconstruction of Gaza if there is a, quote, clear path to a Palestinian state. Well, Blinken, speaking during his tour of the region, also said he was crystal clear that Palestinians must be able to return to their homes as soon as conditions allow, and said the U.S. rejects any proposal for settling them outside the territory, despite Israeli officials openly calling for the resettlement of Palestinians outside Gaza. Take a listen.
Israel's campaign moves to a lower intensity phase in northern Gaza, and as the IDF scales down its forces there, we agreed today on a plan for the UN to carry out an assessment mission. It will determine what needs to be done to allow displaced Palestinians to return safely to homes in the north. Now, this is not going to happen overnight. There are serious security, infrastructure, and humanitarian challenges. But the mission will start a process that evaluates these obstacles and how they can be overcome. In today's meetings, I was also crystal clear. Palestinian civilians must be able to return home as soon as conditions allow. They must not be pressed to leave Gaza.
Mr. Thompson, what did you make of those comments there? You briefly touched upon it earlier, but the rhetoric that came out of Blinken's mouth there does not really match what the U.S. is actually doing on the ground.
No, it's just political talk. It's, blown smoke in one's eyes. Again, you have to look at the results. When he talks about the Palestinian people should return, well, certainly there's millions of refugees have been forced out of their homes and villages and towns throughout the entire area. They should be allowed to return. It's under national law. Yeah. It's common natural law. And yet they're forbidden. And even though there have been many actions presented to the UN where they have declared it should be, it hasn't happened. So, again, it's a very simple form. What are the results? One can get up there and speak as much as they want and say the right words and we want to hear this and this is really good. But what are the results? And the results are, as we speak, they are still bombing, they're still killing defenseless people. These people don't have any arms.
Yeah.
They don't have any planes of any description or any rockets. Why don't you send in Stinger missiles, which they did in Afghanistan to fight against the Russians? That'll help change the situation. No, they're talking empty words, and the results are extermination.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a fact of what's happening as we sit here today.
And Mick, another thing, the many things that the U.S. Secretary of State said in that press conference was that the need for an integrated approach, not his exact words, but integrated approach. To one analyst I was listening to at the time, that was code for normalization with Saudi Arabia in the middle of a genocide against Palestinians. Your comment on that?
Well, yes. I mean, the Palestinian resistance breakout on October the 7th and the killing of hundreds of Israeli soldiers has changed everything across the area. And Blinken's got a hard task here. because the Saudis were ready to normalize and the Palestinian resistance rendered that completely impossible. Because Saudis, Emiratis, Moroccans, etc., can all watch genocide live on their own TVs. They can see, for the first time in human history, an attempt to exterminate tens and hundreds of thousands of people live on TV. Blinken's words are an attempt to balance between support for that mass murder, which is unstinting, but also to say something for their allies, whose citizens can see people being killed because they're Arabs, because they're Palestinians, because they're not Jews. Mm. So he has to try to throw them a scrap that they can throw to their own citizens to try to blunt the anger and the rage that's felt across the Middle East. Otherwise, it has no meaning. I mean, to allow the Palestinians to return to Gaza when the security situation allows means when Israel decides that they're allowed to. Yeah. So when you look at the detail of what's said, it's a green light for Israel to do what it wants and a fig leaf for America's allies not to take action in order to stop the genocide.
It definitely is. And Mr. Thompson, the fact that Blinken said that there are allies in the region, Qatar, Turkey, and others, UAE, having told him that they would help reconstruct Gaza if and when this genocide comes to an end, don't you think that there is more that these countries could do other than wait until Israel achieves its supposed goals?
Absolutely. They have to come out very strongly and say to the Washington government, stop the extermination of these people, and to Tel Aviv as well.
Yeah.
That's the very first thing that has to happen, truly has to happen, is the killing has to stop. The slaughter has to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And the slaughter goes on day and night.
I'm afraid, yeah.
Using the most advanced weaponry ever to kill off defenseless people.
First things first.
And these politicians, and I'm referring now to London, who voted for the massacre to carry on under the disguise of calling a ceasefire, and the so-called opposition, the Labour Party, abstained from voting, which was they were voting to carry it on because they knew if their people went in to vote, it would probably go against the stopping of the massacre. So they wanted to carry it on. Mm. They are guilty. They're accessories to mass murder and extermination.
All right. This, just a reminder, is Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pourza, where we take a deep dive into the news of and around the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. The pain of the occupation of Palestine runs across generations of Palestinians, from young to old, in Palestine and abroad. Earlier, we spoke to a Palestinian child based in London, Ali Al-Zubaydi, and asked him what his thoughts were on what is going on in Gaza.
It's really hard to watch, really, because every time I see it, I think that I could be over there, and just wondering how painful it would be to be there during war, being bombed. I can't think about it. I understand that people are claiming land, and people came, and they just started taking over, and Gaza didn't have the supplies at the time, but everyone at Israel came armed, and that's how it started. When we go to protests, me and my family, I make sure that I take some role that makes me stand out, because when I go to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I want to say that I've done something. They make us write Israel rather than Palestine, which I feel is appalling, considering I go to an Islamic school. If we all say something, we all take stances, we all do our best, I hope they'll change. I would say, imagine your child, your son, your daughter, imagine they're in Palestine. They don't have medicine, they don't have power, they don't have water, they don't have free hospital, they don't have education. And a lot of the population in Gaza are just children. They can't do anything. So please, please, yeah, please, I hope Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes it so that you are convinced to try help Palestine. I know many people my age who are well-educated and agree with me on what's happening. I feel that, inshallah, a few years or sooner than that, inshallah, we'll get down, the war will end and Palestine will win.
Ali Al-Zubaydi speaking with us earlier. Now, the League of Arab States at the United Nations say they're working tirelessly on a request to grant the State of Palestine permanent membership within the international organization. The bloc, which represents Arab states at the UN, say they are pushing hard to achieve their primary objectives, which include a ceasefire, additional humanitarian assistance, and the stop of forced transfers.
Today, our goal is, for first and foremost, for the United Nations to take all the necessary measures through its organs, especially the Security Council, for a ceasefire. This is of paramount importance for the lives and for the humanitarian disaster that's happening now in Gaza. The ceasefire is the key element that we have to work for. The other issue is to allow humanitarian aid in and access to it. We welcome the appointment of Ms. Kag as a coordinator for humanitarian aid, but we think that without a ceasefire, her mandate will be significantly curtailed. We look forward to work with her in this regard and for the aid to move forward at a pace which will allow the alleviation of the suffering.
The obstacle is in the Security Council. We need to find a solution to that obstacle and to remove it from the path so that the State of Palestine assume its rightful place as a member state of the United Nations.
Mick Napier, just briefly, what is the significance of Palestine having a permanent seat at the UN?
Completely irrelevant at the moment when they're being murdered in many, in huge numbers. The Arab governments and my own government in Scotland uses this as an alternative to taking concrete action. If the Arab governments were to stop the oil flowing, then the attack on Gaza could be stopped very, very quickly. They have the power at their fingertips. And in the current situation where Russia is also incentivized to join this sort of pressure against the Western governments, it would be absolutely unstoppable. So the Arab governments are talking about Palestine becoming a state recognized by the UN, but they're refusing to take the action which they can easily take and which would be supported by their own populations. So yes, it's a side issue. It's smoke and mirrors. I don't mean it's without any symbolic significance. The Zionists in normal times would hate it and they would oppose it, but it's not a big thing. The main thing is to take practical measures like the Yemenis are taking in order to defend the people of Gaza.
Smoke and mirrors. Desmond Thompson, quickly, your thoughts on Foreign Secretary David Cameron, who was put to task yesterday by a parliamentary committee on whether Israel has broken international law in Gaza. 3 months on.
Well, with David Cameron, when he was prime minister, he publicly declared that he would personally defend Zionist Israel from a personal basis when he was prime minister the last time. So that speaks volumes for where he's at.
Exactly.
Again, and to use mixed terms, smoke and mirrors, that's it's another thing. I want to comment on the Palestinian who made a statement there at the UN. They're looking for a
brief
solution.
If you can,
they don't have to look for a solution. The solution is stop the killing, and then have a solution throughout the entire area, equal rights for everyone.
Exactly.
That's the way to go. In fact, it's the most ethical way to go. And
quickly, what kind of support do you think we should provide to people such as Mick or other people who are facing these measures by governments to try and suppress their voices?
Never give up. Take to the streets. And as Mick says, even though he should get arrested or thrown into court, he's going to stand up for the truth. And that's what will defeat these so-called politicians and governments and political organizations, because they're all involved and they're all part of this massacre and extermination.
All right. It looks like I have 1 minute to go, Mick. The threat of a regional war that is still there, the continued attacks on southern Lebanon by the Israeli regime, the American-led force in the Red Sea, attacks on the Yemeni Navy, the only force in the area that's actually doing something to stop ships that are bound for Israel. How serious a threat is that, very briefly?
It's a serious threat. Israel can kill huge numbers of Palestinian civilians. But against the Palestinian resistance, they're having a very hard time. And against the battle-hardened, fighters in Yemen who are so prepared to stand up to defend Gaza, in which activity they are enforcing international law, because such international law enjoins every state anywhere in the world, they must take action to prevent something they recognize as genocide. So I think Israel is surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs. It's only because they're prevented from taking action in support of the Palestinians that Israel can do what it's doing. And I think the people of the Middle East joined together in an axis of resistance and determined to come to the support of the people of Gaza will prevail. The arithmetic is all with them. But for the moment, the Gazans face a terrible, completely mad enemy with a bloodthirst and a bloodlust, which Blinken is doing.
They surely do. They surely do. McNapier, Desmond Thompson, thank you both for your thoughts.
Thank you.
And thank you. Join us again for more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
In the Limelight.
The United Nations Population Fund estimated that there were approximately 50,000 pregnant women in Gaza when the Zionist regime declared its war during October. Those women have been denied adequate care, and it has frequently been impossible for them to attend medical appointments. Just 15 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals are functioning, and in all those 15 cases, only partially. With acute food shortages, most pregnant women are malnourished. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Noor was pregnant when the Zionist regime ordered that she leave her Gaza City apartment. While moving southwards, she had a severe pain in her abdomen. The pain intensified, but she did her best to conceal it. While the pain disappeared after a while, she encountered further problems after she took shelter, along with her husband and two children, at her uncle's home in Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city. Each time there was a bombardment of the neighborhood, Noor felt more abdominal pain followed by bleeding. Worried about the possibility of a miscarriage, she went to Al Hilal Al Emirati Maternity Hospital in Rafah, accompanied by her aunt. The imaging section in the hospital was full when she arrived. There were only 5 beds available in the section and just one doctor, yet there were tens of pregnant women. After waiting for 3 hours, a nurse called out Noor's name. Noor was asked to lie down on a bed so that she could be examined. Noor told one of the staff at the hospital about the pains and bleeding she was experiencing. She was informed that such problems were probably caused by the constant stress and the fear of living through a war. Soon after that trip, Noor, then 7 months pregnant, felt that she was going into labor. She was brought to a hospital by car. As no beds were available, she had to give birth in a waiting area. Her new baby was a boy named Ahmad. He was just 1.5 kilograms in weight. Ahmad was placed in an incubator. Within the following 2 weeks, he gained 500 grams in weight. Noor said, When I got him out of the incubator, I didn't know what he should wear. I didn't find any baby clothes in the stores. My aunt borrowed some winter clothes from her neighbors, but couldn't find enough baby milk cans for him in the pharmacies. The United Nations Population Fund estimated that there were approximately 50,000 pregnant women in Gaza when the Zionist regime declared its war during October. The women have been denied adequate care, and it has frequently been impossible for them to attend medical appointments. Just 15 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals are functioning, and in all those 15 cases, only partially. With acute food shortages, most pregnant women are malnourished. Amal had a miscarriage a few weeks after the Zionist regime destroyed her family's home. Her parents and some of her siblings were killed in the massacre. Married in 2015, Amal was told by her doctor a few years later that getting pregnant would be difficult. She had spent thousands of dollars on fertility treatment since then. It was not until 2023 that she became pregnant. Her due date was approaching when her parents were killed. The shock of that horrific crime was so acute that all she could do afterwards was recite the Noble Quran and look at the photographs of her family members on her phone. She lost her appetite. When she made herself eat anything, she vomited. 1 week after the attack on her family, Amal started bleeding heavily. She screamed. Her husband drove her as fast as possible to a nearby hospital. There, she learned that she had miscarried. Amal said, "I was killed twice," explaining that she herself felt like she died both when the massacre of her family occurred and during the subsequent miscarriage. She added, "It will be difficult for me to have any life now." Amal had been due to have a son. She had prepared a room, cot, and clothes for him. She had not yet chosen his name. Also, Sondos, 26, was 9 months pregnant when her home in Ramal, a Gaza City neighborhood, was targeted. Her husband and daughter were killed in the attack. Sondos managed to survive after being rescued from the rubble. She and her family had remained in the northern half of Gaza after the Zionist regime ordered their evacuation. They did not have any relatives or friends who could host them if they moved southwards. Sondos was brought to Gaza City's Al-Hilo Hospital. There, she gave birth to a girl through a section. She called her daughter Habiba. The baby sister, who the Zionist regime had just killed, had the same name. The baby had to be placed in an incubator. Sondos did not have enough food or clean water over the past few months, and that had an adverse effect on the baby's weight. The hospital was unable to provide any anesthesis during childbirth, and Sondos was in acute pain. Sondos said, "I forgot the pain once I held my baby in my arms. I thank God that I was granted a new child on the day I lost my other daughter."
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we are talking about the concept of human being in the Holy Quran, and we ended up talking about different dimensions of the human being, and we're talking about the fitra as one important dimension, aspect of the creation and in the creation of the human being, and different functions and roles that fitra has, innate nature, godly given nature of fitra to us, and what functions it has and what roles it plays throughout the journey that we have toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And another dimension and aspect of the human being is heart. The heart, or in Arabic, al-qalb, another name for that is fu'ad. In the Holy Quran, it has been repeated several times, and there are different discussions about this. One of them is that the heart, some people would say that in the ancient times, people didn't know that the brain is the main part of the human awareness, and because of that, that was a mistake in the biology, or I don't know, medical sciences of the time. And that's why the Holy Quran also has fallen into this mistake, for example. Some might think like that. But the fact of the matter is that Quran talks with the common sense language. It's not a scientific book on medicine or medical sciences to say, for example, what part is responsible for what. I give you an example. We nowadays, we know that it is the earth that revolves around the sun. But in our day-to-day language, we say, for example, I tell you, okay, today that the sun rises, I will talk to you at the sunrise. You cannot tell me, okay, you said sunrise, as if you believe the sun is moving, and you're from the old like school of astronomy, Ptolemaic system. No, this is the normal language that we use. It doesn't mean we believe that the sun rises. And actually, it sounds a bit different or a bit far-fetched if I say, okay, at the moment that the earth revolves around itself so that it looks that the sun is... No, nobody talks like that. They say the sun rises. They say the sun arrives here at the sky. They don't say that the earth is moving and it looks as if the sun is... No. So, also is true about the heart. People in the past would find it, even nowadays, we say, for example, I love you with all my heart. And nobody says this is, the heart is not responsible for the feelings. Feelings actually is part of your brain doing this. No, they say heart is the center of emotions. Why? Because you get actions and reactions of the heart when you get emotional, for example. You have the heartbeat, your heart skips a bit, or things that happens when you have emotions, like fear, like love, like enthusiasm. So Quran speaks in the language that people understand. And even today, with all the advances in medicine and everything, we still use the heart when we want to talk about that core of our being, that the corner of our being that is actually responsible for serious matters in our existence. So people in the past were also aware of this when they were reading the Holy Quran. And they would say that this heart is not the physical heart. This heart is actually referring to one dimension of the soul. Inshallah, we continue the discussion after a break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the concept of heart, qalb, or fu'ad, in the Holy Quran, and we said that this word refers to one dimension of the human soul in the Holy Quran. And after knowing this, we realized that the role that this part plays in the overall journey and being of mankind is a great role, and there are some indications for that. One of them is the fact that there are verses that say that Quran was revealed to the heart of the Prophet. Now, it doesn't say we revealed the Quran to your intellect or to your soul or to your ruh. No, the verses say that نَزَلَ بِهَا الرُّوحُ الْأَمِينَ عَلَىٰ قَلْبِكَ. Ruh al-Amin, which is a name for Jibra'il alayhi salam, brought down the message to your heart. Now it shows that there's a function that this heart has that no other dimension and part of the soul can do. قُلْ مَنْ كَانَ عَدُوًا لِجِبْرِيلِ فَإِنَّهُ نَزَّلَهُ عَلَىٰ قَلْبِكَ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. The greatest revelation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. إِنَّا سَنُلْغِي عَلَيْكَ قَوْلًا ثَقِيلًا. We talked about this, that it is the greatest and heaviest word that has ever been revealed to any person in the history of mankind. And in the person who received it, actually, in the history of mankind, received it with the heart. And that should not surprise us, because when we go to other ahadith, we realize that the heart is actually the greatest thing ever created. And it might sound a bit surprising to you, but wait, we will explain. Why do I make such a claim that the heart is the greatest and largest and vastest, if it is correct to use, of all the creation? Why? Because there is a hadith Qudsi. Hadith Qudsi is a hadith that has been narrated from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the angels. It's not Quran. Another thing that distinguishes Quran from other ahadith, from other things, is that Quran is a unique thing, different from hadith Qudsi. The hadith Qudsi says, يقول الله عز وجل لا يسعني أرضي ولا سمائي ولكن يسعني قلب عبدي المؤمن. My heaven, the heaven that I have created, the earth that I have created, they don't have room, enough room for me. But only I find enough room in the heart of my believing servant. يسعني قلب عبدي المؤمن. It is only the heart of my believing servant that enclose me. Or it's not to say enclose me, but it has room for me. Let's say like that. So you see, the heart of a believing person is the largest and greatest among all the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is a long discussion, and we have arrived at the end of this episode. Inshallah, in the following episode, we continue this discussion and the role and functions of heart according to the verses of the Holy Quran. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Germany probably ended 2023 with its first recession since the coronavirus pandemic, as analysts reckon data will reveal a second straight contraction in output in the fourth quarter of 2023. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. German industrial output unexpectedly declined in November, underscoring the persistent manufacturing woes in Europe's largest economy. The Statistics Office of Germany said on Tuesday, 9th of January, production declined 0.7% from October, led by capital goods. and intermediate goods. That's the sixth consecutive drop and defies economists in a Bloomberg survey who'd predicted a 0.3% increase. Germany probably ended 2023 with its first recession since the coronavirus pandemic, as analysts reckon data will reveal a second straight contraction in output in the fourth quarter of 2023. Manufacturers, Germany's economic backbone, are struggling from costly energy, higher global interest rates, and a slowdown in the Chinese economy. Bloomberg economists said disappointing November production data and the recent business expectations deterioration point to a bumpy start to the year for industry in Germany. We maintain our baseline view for a slight gross domestic product increase in the first quarter of 2024, driven by a higher dynamic in the service sector. There is substantial risk, however, that a more pronounced industry weakness will drag the economy down again in the first quarter of 2024. The figures come just a day after a reading for factory orders also fell short of expectations. Additionally, with the German government straitjacketed over ramping up investment and train strikes looming recently, few economists anticipate much of a pickup this year. German railway operator Deutsche Bahn AG's attempt to halt strikes by a court injunction was rejected by Frankfurt's labor court on Monday, 8th of January. Speaking to Bloomberg Television after Tuesday data was released, Holger Schmieding, chief economist at Berenberg, claimed Germany is experiencing cyclical rather than structural issues and will bounce back as the manufacturing sector returns to significant growth in the second half of 2024. He said Germany was in recession last year. Yes, but the indicators are starting to stabilize. We are bottoming out in the German economy. Meanwhile, citing the country's federal network agency, the German magazine Der Spiegel writes, households in Germany will continue to struggle with high electricity and heating costs amid the cost-of-living crisis. The warning comes despite the recent fall in household energy prices, which have decreased 4.5% this year compared to November of last year. The head of the Federal Network Agency, Klaus Müller, was quoted as saying in an interview with the Rheinische Post, "The era of cheap energy is over, at least as long as we continue to consume large quantities of conventionally generated energy." Klaus Müller added, "Although wholesale electricity prices have fallen significantly compared to 2022, the price level is still higher than before the start of the Ukraine conflict," adding that nothing will change in the near future. The energy regulator noted that an average four-person household will pay 120 euros more in network fees per year due to the government's decision to eliminate the previously planned 5.5 billion euros subsidy. Müller assumed network operators will pass the price rise on to German customers, predicting sooner or later the cost will reach all consumers regardless of when the changes are implemented. Germany's transmission system operators reportedly announced in mid-December that the grid fees will rise from 3.12 cents per kilowatt hour in 2023 to 6.43 cents next year. Germany, which relied on Russia for 40% of its natural gas demand before 2022, was among the hardest hit by the reduction of Russian energy supplies to Europe last year. Deliveries were either significantly curtailed or entirely halted after the European Union imposed sanctions on Moscow in response to the Ukraine conflict, and the Nord Stream pipelines delivered Russian gas to Germany mysteriously blew up. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. German farmers started a week of nationwide protests early on Monday, 8th of January, in response to plans to phase out agricultural subsidies as the coalition government scrambles to fix its finances. Images showed convoys of tractors and trucks, some adorned with protest banners, on German roads in sub-zero pre-dawn temperatures. German police reports said that roads and highway ramps were blocked in multiple locations, causing traffic jams during the morning rush hour. Farmers have vowed to blockade major traffic and logistics routes throughout next week, on Monday, 15th of January, as they warn that an end to tax breaks will drive farms out of business. The head of German Farmers Association, DBV, asked the public for sympathy in an interview published on Monday, 8th of January. He told the Stern magazine, "We do not want to lose the support and solidarity we have received from large parts of the German population." But he said the farmers will not accept the planned tax hikes for the agricultural sector. Recent backlash from farmers prompted the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition, racing to finalize a 2024 budget draft that was delayed by a court ruling, to make unexpected changes, including modifying plans to cut subsidies for agriculture. Rather than abruptly ending the farmers' tax breaks on agricultural diesel, the subsidy will be reduced by 40% this year, by 30% next year, and will end entirely in 2026. The government also dropped plans to abolish the preferential treatment in vehicle tax for forestry and agriculture. However, the DBV said the changes were not enough and stuck with plans for protests in the coming days. Russia's Sputnik news agency has also covered the same story. According to an opinion poll by YouGov, at least 74% of the German public disapprove of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's performance, making it the highest level of dissatisfaction on record for a sitting German chancellor. At least 77% of the German public also said they place little to no trust in the way Olaf Scholz governs the country. And according to a separate opinion poll by Infotest Dimap, if elections were held today, Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party, the SPD, would receive just 14% of the vote, which is 2% less than last month's figure and the lowest since June of 2021. A whopping 73% of the public also said they were unhappy with the traffic light coalition government, making it the worst monthly figure since the coalition first came to power. The opinion poll comes when Germany's economy has been particularly struggling ever since the government failed to repurpose 60 billion euros left over from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were we're just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there, too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, these are children.
Exactly.
Children
They're innocent.
Are harmless, so.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing, and he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun, and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together with the code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing.